Initially, when I walked into being a parent, I thought that my responsibility was to teach my children. And what I have learned of the time of being a parent, that it is my time to be taught also by my children.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a teacher at McKenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. By training, Jack is a philosopher, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced for over 20 years in California and Oregon. Along with her husband Larry, she is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Christianity at Work in Relationships, Jack and Christine discuss how God teaches us to trust Him through the experiences of everyday life. Here now are Jack and Christine.
Jack and I, you and I talked a lot about biblical concepts, and I really liked doing that. It was very instructive. But I have to say, Jack, that I really enjoy doing the series that we have embarked again upon, which is looking at relationships. That's kind of where my heart beats, and I really, really do like being here. We're talking again today about parenting. We talked last week about parenting, and this is our second in a series of we don't know how long. I guess I should tell people that. Lots of times people ask me, do you have an outline? And no, very often we don't. We have some ideas written down. Sometimes out of one sentence we'll spend maybe three or maybe more broadcasts talking about something that really kind of we feel like we have something we want to say, a soapbox we want to stand on, or something that's important to us. And so that's true here also about parenting. But I have a bunch of ideas that are important to me. Bunch of ideas, I say, because I don't have a lot of formulation about being a parent any more than I really do about being a person. I try really hard. I make hypotheses about what I think would be a good way to go, and I try it out. But I never really know for sure how to live my life. I'm always kind of trying it out with this one goal in mind of how do I pursue what's right? How do I be loving? What's good? Those are the questions that are before me, and I try and walk in that direction. That's certainly the direction that I try to walk in my parenting. So I think when I began parenting, it was very different. What I wanted was I had a kind of a focus, as I'm trying to remember back, on what I was going to have my child do, how I was going to get my child to be obedient. You're shaking your head, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I read books that try to help me understand how to discipline, what to do about this situation or that situation, how to get them to be kids that kind of did the right thing, stayed in line. That kind of thing was kind of my focus. And over the years, I've changed my focus. And the question that I ask myself more and more is, how do I just love my children? What do I do? How do I pour myself out? How do I sacrifice myself for my kids? Rather than, I think, without knowing it, my intent before was, how do I get my children to be people that didn't cause me quite so much discomfort? And that's really what I want to go away from. Even if it causes me discomfort, what do I do that's in their best interest? And when it's in their best interest, it really is in my best interest also. But it's a really hard question to say, how do I love my children? It used to be a simple answer for me to figure out how to love, but it's not a simple answer for me anymore. What's in the best interest of another person? How do you cherish them? How do you do what's right? It's not simple. It's difficult. It's challenging. It takes a lot of wisdom, a lot of life, a lot of learning, a tremendous amount of humility.
I was involved in a panel discussion the other day at McKenzie Study Center, and my brother was on the panel, and I like the way he put it. He was talking about marriage and said one thing we need to recognize about marriage is that in entering into marriage, I am making the woman who is my wife my study. And what he meant by that is that I need to, over the course of time, learn who she is and therefore how best to love her. I would say the same thing is true of children. They become my study. I need to get to know them, to understand them. Who did God make them to be? And it's only by understanding them that I can really know the answer to the question you're raising. How best do I love this child? And it's not going to be the same for every child. I mean, even in the same family, all of my children are different. And how best I love them, how I relate to them, how I handle them, is really going to be in large part dependent upon them. What do they need, and what support, what nurture can I give them that's going to allow them to grow into the creature that God made them to be? So we don't come automatically equipped knowing the answer to that question.
Nor does any book come.
Pardon?
Nor does any book come to tell us the answer to that question. And that's where books can go wrong really very often, is they have these particular techniques or rules that we're supposed to abide by. But I think they're often missing the very core of the issue is, who is my child? How do I get to know my child?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think one of the obstacles for me in getting to know my child and loving them is I get running really fast. I get going really, really fast.
You mean just in life?
My life.
Yeah.
You know, I've just a tremendous amount to do and a tremendous amount that I love to do. I would love to know the meaning of the word bored. I just don't know. I just don't know what that's about, because I have so many things that I just really love to do and want to do and am involved in doing. And that's a real challenge for me, is to slow down enough to really pay attention and see who my children are, because it really does take that slowing down time to do that. And I think I've failed in many ways as a parent, but I think that's one way in particular that I have failed. Even if I didn't work, I think I would go very fast. That's a weakness of mine, and I've slowed down tremendously in the last many years, but I have a ways to go. I was listening to a tape, Jack, somewhat recently. Actually, I want to tell you what I'm thinking, because it's kind of bugging me right now. I remember early on when we were talking about this radio program, Dave Winchester, one of the people who's on the board, is a radio producer. Is that what he's called?
Station manager.
Manager. He said, "Christina, what I want you to do in the first sentence or two, I want you to shut up and let Jack talk." I was just very aware that I had quite a monologue at the beginning of this, and my technique isn't too good. But I think in many ways we've got to throw technique to the wind and just do our best.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was bugging me, so now it's off my list.
Okay.
What I was starting to say is that recently I was listening to a tape by a man who... I have been told has had cancer for about 15 years, and yet he is still a pastor and still very much has a ministry, and they kind of expected him to die a long time ago, but he keeps on living. And his message is to go around and tell people. He's actually a pastor, did I say that? But his message is to talk about the love of God, because he's really experienced that and known that in his life through probably much through the cancer. And when he started the tape, he said, "Well, you guys, if you ever heard me, you know what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about the love of God again." And really, he was a man who had been... I don't think I agree with all of his theology, but I certainly appreciate his heart. And one of the things that he said was that what our children need is really to be believed in, for us to be the people who are standing behind them. And he said that a lot of times. But I didn't quite, it was too, I know it came from his heart, and I know he meant it, but how do we believe in our children? I think we could go a wrong way. We could believe in whatever they do without any kind of direction, just to make them feel good about themselves, just to kind of stroke their egos. And that's not really loving them. Loving them is much more difficult than saying something easy like, believe in our children.
My brother is a social worker, counselor, who has worked a lot with either delinquent children or criminals, and he's mentioned on a couple of occasions that people with the highest level of self-esteem that he knows are criminals, are the people in the penitentiary. and that's what's so incredibly wrong about the emphasis, the false emphasis on self-esteem in our culture today, is that unrealistic self-esteem is not really helpful, where you think you're better than everybody else and you have rights that other people don't have because you're basically superior and you're basically more entitled than other people. That's not at all healthy. We want to guide our children into that healthy self-acceptance of recognizing that they are who they are and they are not other than that. They're not better than they are. They're not worse than they are. They are who they are, and I find them totally intriguing, being who, the person that God has made them to be. I mean, if that's what he means by believe in them, that I'm their fan, and I'm their fan not because I give them an inflated view of their abilities or their talents or their, you know, the wonder of who they are. They just are this ordinary person, just like other people in the world, but I'm their biggest fan and I'll always be on their side. If that's what he means, then of course I agree with that. But it's very possible to take that in the direction of trying to, using the strategy where I give them an unrealistic, inflated fantasy of who they are. And I flatter them into believing lies about themselves. That's not at all healthy. That's not helpful. Now, I don't know, is that what you were talking about? Or?
Well, I'm not sure exactly where he was going. It sounded like a really nice thing to go for, to believe in your children. And I think probably in his heart he had some really great ways to do that. But that is the direction that I'd go in, what you were saying. But I think lots of times we throw out things like, let's love our children, let's believe in them, let's be behind them, let's be supportive of them. And it's really hard to understand what that really means, because lots of times what we do is what you're describing. We flatter them in ways that are unrealistic and give them a perception of themselves that just really isn't true. You know, I think I've learned the best of life in every way, I think. I think I've learned the most about how to parent through my husband. And paradoxically, not through his parenting, but through the way he has loved me.
Mm-hmm.
I think that he has been a better lover of me than he has of our children, for whatever reason. I think if he was here today, he might not love me saying that, but I think he'd agree with me. And what I've experienced in him, and maybe this is why it caught my ear to be believed in, is he has been on my side. He's been on my team. And I am, as I said in other shows, very, very different than him. Sometimes I think rather embarrassing person. I must be to him. Rather off the wall sometimes. He's kind of quiet. He's very thoughtful, and he kind of sits back and kind of pays attention to things, and I just go full bore ahead. But nonetheless, even as I'm different than he is, he's not tried to change me into being like him. And I think that's how he's believed in me.
Mm-hmm.
He has loved me into being me. He hasn't done that by being really... he's not really complimentary. He doesn't give me a whole lot of praise. He doesn't tell me how great I am all the time, or...
Doesn't lie to you.
Wow, come on, Jack.
Oh, he does.
I was thinking, wait a minute, Jack, he should be complimentary all the time. That's not a lie. I just am great all the time. That's the way kind of I'd like to see myself. But no, he hasn't lied to me. And even sometimes, like when I'm all dressed up and I want a compliment from him, he doesn't give it to me, and I'd like it more then. But I've just learned to say, do I look beautiful tonight? And he'll tell me that I do. In fact, there's this song, and perhaps you've heard it. It's really quite a lovely song. This man is singing to a woman, and he says, "You look beautiful tonight." Tucker, do you know that song? What are some of the words?
By Eric Clapton.
By Eric Clapton, yeah. My husband really likes Eric Clapton. And he plays that on the CD for me sometimes, and it's really quite lovely. But generally speaking, he doesn't say those things to me a lot, which I think in our culture we've said we've got to really stroke kids, we've really got to praise them and each other. And I certainly think there's a place for that, and I think he could improve in that. But I think I could forego all that for the bigger thing that he's given me. It is a sacrifice from his heart to want me to be who I am. Like your brother said, to make me a study and to see who I am and to give me opportunities, to give me freedom, to give me space to develop whatever that is. He very rarely tells me what to do. I don't remember ever. He very rarely will direct me, even if perhaps he wouldn't make that same decision. He will let me make my decisions, and I'll fail, and he'll never say, I told you so. He'll just be there to help me look at and understand what has gone wrong or what has gone right. Those are incredible gifts to me, and I think that's the way we really need to love our children.
Yeah. Yeah, that's helpful. I could understand maybe that's what this guy meant, to believe in your children, if what we mean by that is, I believe that the creature God made you to be is an interesting, intriguing, valid, worthwhile, substantial person that I appreciate for who you are. I mean, to believe in somebody in that sense, I think, is exactly what we as parents need to do. The real temptation is, if you take something like, I think we've talked about this before, if you take something like human intelligence, how do you measure human intelligence? Well, any given society is going to measure that in very narrow bands. How you do academically, that's a person who's intelligent. How much money you make, that's a person who's intelligent. You know, we maybe have three, how creative and artistic you are, that's human intelligence. We may have, you know, three or four, or half a dozen, or even a dozen different measures of a person's intelligence. And if they score high on those particular scales, then we say they're intelligent. If they don't score high on those scales, they're not intelligent. Well, that doesn't really make any sense, because from my perspective, every human creature God makes is interesting, deep, intriguing. We human beings can manage to bury some of that pretty deeply and turn people into, make them into people who are relatively in the safety of their cocoon, not as interesting. But I don't think they came from God that way.
Safety of their cocoon, where they've been so hurt that they're hiding.
Yeah. But I think as God made them, there's not an uninteresting person on the earth. But the question I have to ask with respect to my children, do I want a child who's going to stand out according to the world's criteria, according to my culture's criteria? Or do I want a child who just does stand out if you look closely enough, if you get to know them, if you understand the creature that God made them to be? They are really outstanding, and that's fine with me. It's okay with me that they just are outstanding. It doesn't matter to me whether the rest of society recognizes that or not. But what's so tempting is, I go, but yes, I know they're outstanding, but doggone it, I want society to recognize that. I want all those other people out there to eat their heart out at what an outstanding child I have. And so I need to steer them. I need to steer them into becoming somebody who's successful in exactly the right ways, in exactly the right categories, so that the rest of the world will stand up and applaud. Well, how do I do that? I have to start manipulating. I have to start intimidating. I have to start criticizing my child. No, don't be that way. Be this way over here, because I know it has more social currency. Well, that's exactly the opposite of believing in them, because it's not sufficient that they be the outstanding creature that God made them be. I want them to be the outstanding creature that the society will recognize them for. And so it's not good enough that you're just outstanding, invisibly outstanding, as God has created you. If that's what believe in them means, then I wholeheartedly support that. I am your fan for who God made you to be. You don't need to change.
I want to add a little piece. You said I'm trying to make them outstanding so that people will see them that way, and I think ultimately so then they'll see me that way.
Yeah, exactly. That's
it's
very selfish.
Me.
Yeah,
it's not really as much about even how the world will see them, but how the world will ultimately see me.
Yeah, exactly. That's true.
So, yeah, that's what I mean by belief. And what you're not saying is I'm telling them they're outstanding and that they're different or more unique than any other person, but the reality is we are all outstanding.
Yeah.
And what we miss is that understanding about ourselves. And I think in great measure as parents, we help our children miss their outstandingness by being selfish, by trying to have them reflect positively on ourselves. It is a big, big deal. It is a very, very difficult thing to help our children understand how they're outstanding. And I think a great measure of why we can't do that, we don't do that, is because we don't really recognize that, really, truly recognize that in other people. It has taken me to be a counselor for 20 years, I think, to really understand the outstandingness of many people. I have a really hard time if I, reflexively, sometimes I don't like people, but I have a really hard time not liking people because I've seen them so much. I feel very strongly toward, for example, the person who has been victimized, but I also feel very strongly toward the victimizer. I see in them qualities. I see in them humanness. I see in them strivings. I see, like, perhaps that's what your brother was saying when he said the strong people of the world are those that are the criminals. And I don't know exactly what he meant by that, but one take that I have is that very often the criminals are people who are not laying down and saying, it's okay to give up myself. Lots of them are trying to maintain a sense of themselves or their own integrity, their own power, or their own something that's valuable. They're doing it in a way that's working against themselves and against society and maybe very immoral. But there's something at their core that's trying to stand up. And I think very often what we do is we lay down and give up. We might look really good, but we're giving up the most essential parts of our character in order to make somebody else feel good, in order to make ourselves feel comfortable. I think very often we do that to kids, our children. We try to make them be what's important to us rather than have them stand up and become their own people. I very much, I don't counsel a lot of children or a lot of adolescents, maybe 10% of my practice is that, but that's across the board what I see from kids. Is they're trying to figure out who they are. They're trying to make choices themselves, and I really applaud that in them. I'll tell them, you are really trying not to lose yourself. That's an important thing. Let's just look at the way that you're doing that.
That raises a question that maybe we could explore, and that is one way that a person could understand what you're saying about it's important that children, how did you put it, make their own decisions? Is that what you said?
Develop their sense of self, have personal integrity, have a sense of their own identity, those kinds of things.
Where do you draw the line between relinquishing your responsibility as a parent for your children, their well-being, their safety, and so on, and developing the sense of self, as you put it? I could imagine some parent, in fact, I see it all around me in the parenting choices of my children's peers in school, they're almost absentee parents. And what I mean by that is they really don't seem to have any input at all into the decisions that their children make. Now, would you support that? I mean, do you think that's a good thing? Or what would be the implications of what you're saying about developing a sense of themselves?
So what you're saying is it sounds like I'm saying parents just need to back off and
themselves. It could be taken that way, and is that what you're saying? I should think you're not saying that, but help me sort that out.
You know, Jack, that's not what I'm saying, but it's really hard to articulate exactly what is good parenting and how do you do it? No, you certainly don't pull out from your children's lives, and yet you do pull out from your children's lives. You know, there's a lot of wisdom in that. What are some times when I should say something and what are some times that I shouldn't say anything? I know, for example, when my kids are... I have a son that's 18 and he's, you know, far along in his high school career. Sometimes he makes some choices about his classes and his studies that I really don't agree with that. I wish he wouldn't do. But, you know, I've told him enough times.
Mm-hmm.
I've laid the foundation, and I think at this point, I think the more harmful thing is for me to get too involved. He needs to make it or not make it based on his own choices. My kids were very interested, for example, in paintballing, and that's where they get these guns that look kind of real, and they shoot paintballs at each other in this kind of organized environment, indoor environment. And I really didn't like that. But I decided that I would allow them to get and spend their own money on these paintball guns. My dad actually sent my son some money, and my son wrote back and said that he spent it on some paintball stuff, and my dad just went nuts. Really, 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 really strongly disagreed with it. And there's some ways that I really agreed with my dad, but what I said to him is sometimes kids just have to go through paintball guns. Certainly there's a limit there to what we let our children choose to do, but they've got to decide for themselves. And after about a year, both my children, who had them, sold their paintball guns. They don't have them anymore. They're not interested in it. But sometimes they have to go ahead and make the choices, make the mistakes, perhaps, go through the experience, whether or not it's a mistake, and then come out on the other side and decide, this is who I am. This is what I want. Now, do I do that without any input? Certainly not. I'll give some input. I'll tell them what I think. But lots of times, I try to tell my children what to think too much. And I think that's really a problem that we have. Either we pull out too far, or we go in too hard. And to have a balance between when do I talk and when do I not is a very difficult one.
So you don't think there are any easy answers?
No, I don't think there's any easy answers.
Okay, but let me give you...
Don't you, Jack?
Well, yeah, I do. I mean, I agree with you. I don't think there are easy answers, but I do think that there are boundaries. And I wouldn't want parents to get the idea that...
Are you getting worried about what I'm saying?
Well, not really. I mean, I think what you're saying is fine. But I just see so much out there in our culture where there are parents who have seemed to have taken the stand that it's a child's job to raise himself. And that doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, what is the stewardship that we've been given if I don't have any role to play? And I'm not sure that it's really they may defend it in terms of the well-being of the child. You know, they've got to grow up, they've got to make their own decisions or whatever. But I think it's just easier for the parent.
Absolutely.
I mean, I think that's what's really going on.
Yes. And it's very harmful. The child ends up feeling this existential aloneness that kind of is pervasive in their soul, and they spend their life hiding from this sense of not having been connected. And that's so very important.
So could you give me an example of where would be a place where you would just say to your children, absolutely not, period? Not just have input to them, but nope, it ain't going to happen. No way.
Well, you know, one of the examples that comes to mind for me is, as my children are at the age of being able to drive and their friends are at the age of being able to drive, one of the things that I've really steered my kids away from and absolutely say no to is they, for example, want to take a long road trip with their friends at age 16. Driving's a really big thing. We are driving a loaded weapon, and kids are just not wise enough, mature enough. They don't have strong enough instincts. They get involved in laughing and enjoying each other. Of course they do, but that's not the place to do it, on the road. And so I just don't allow that. That's absolutely no. My kids think I'm pretty tight. In fact, my kids were here, they'd say, "Oh, Mom, you, there's so many things that you don't let us do." Yet I don't think my children are aware of all the things that I don't involve myself in, that I choose to pull out of, not because I'm not interested, but because I'm disciplining myself to shut up. Like, for example, the paintball guns. Give some input and then shut up, like their grades. Get some input, try to help them, try to be there for them, try to provide support or even tutoring for them. But ultimately, I really try and back off. But there are areas where I think that I just won't allow it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an excellent example. We have the same kind of philosophy there. One of my daughter's friends, we're going to take a significantly long trip with four or five 16, 17, 18-year-old girls in a car together. And we just said, absolutely not. If you want to go there, I will drive you there and come back and get you, but you are not driving in the car. It's that sort of example that has given us the reputation among my daughter's friends as being really incredibly strict. But the thing I keep telling my daughters is one of my jobs is to keep you alive long enough to make decisions for yourself. And they just don't have the perspective, they don't have the experience, they don't have the background and the knowledge to know how dangerous some situations are. And I think that's part of my job, is to assess the literally danger to their person, to their physical well-being, let alone their spiritual well-being. Part of my job is to rely upon my experience to assess the risks involved and sometimes draw the line and say that is so risky that you ain't going to do it.
Well, I think your question was really good. You know, where are some places where we would just draw the line? Do you have any other examples that come to mind for you?
Well, for me, when it comes to sexuality, and I, you know, particularly for my son, I can't, you know, I don't know what it's like to be an adolescent female. And so I can't be as much of a guide there, and I may get all that wrong, but the movies that I would allow my son to watch, there are just some movies where he just shouldn't see them, because I know the impact that it has on an adolescent male. I know what it does. I know how addictive it can be. I know how mind warping it can be, and never mind that all of your classmates have seen that movie. I would draw the line and say, you know, when you're 21 or 22 or 23, you can make up your own mind what you want to do with that. But my job is to get you to an adult brain with enough wisdom to know how to make that decision for yourself. But I guarantee you don't have enough experience and wisdom to make that decision for yourself right now, so you aren't going to watch it.
Or to the best of your ability, you're going to keep
them from
watching.
Yeah, he can always sneak out.
and I think that's the bottom line. There's nothing we can ultimately say no to where they just absolutely won't do. I know from my own experience. I'm just telling one of my parents this last week about some things I did when I was in high school. They were trying to limit, for example, who I dated and how old the guys were that dated. So what I did is I just had a younger guy pick me up and I went out with the older guy. We can get around it. And I think that's really what we need to watch out for when we're parents who are drawing a lot of lines, is if we are too tight, and parents who cannot be reasoned with or talked to, or like your kids when you're talking to them about sexuality, if they can't at least ask you questions or be heard in terms of their own concerns, like all my other friends are doing it. Well, you said never mind. Well, in a sense, never mind in the sense that you're not, Jack, going to be directed as parents about what other children do. But I think it's really important for us to hear how difficult it is that all the other kids get to do that, for example.
Yeah, sure.
That we are involved in our kids' lives, not just in this arbitrary way, but in a way, even though we're trying to look out for their best interest, but that we're really very much involved with them, even as we're saying absolutely no. I need to be willing to be in a conversation about why I don't let my children drive, and I might need to be in it, not to be harassed by them, but I need to be in it maybe 10, 20, 30 times to be able to help them understand it, because they don't have adult minds. They get it. They don't get it. They don't understand the boundaries that we're making because it seems so very reasonable to them.
Right, yeah. And that's why I do need to do the best I can to understand my own intuitions. I mean, sometimes I just have this kind of knee-jerk reaction. No, that wouldn't be a good idea. Why would that not be a good idea, they ask. Raising children is a time for my own education.
Oh, let's underline that. Raising children is a time for my own education.
Yeah.
As well as theirs.
I mean, if I can't answer them right now, I need to do the best I can to try to articulate to myself, why do I have that reaction? Why do I have that intuition? What am I thinking? What's behind my reticence here? So that I can do the best job I can at communicating that to them. And I may not be able to articulate it fully, but at least the effort of articulating as best I can and tell them when my analysis runs short, say, you know, I just don't know, but as best I can tell, here's what I'm thinking, here's what I'm feeling here. At least that communicates to them that I'm not just being arbitrary. I'm not just being a jerk. You know, I'm not just saying no to make your life miserable. I really do have genuine concerns here that I feel deeply. And at least I'm communicating that to them.
And I need to give them an explanation. I remember as a child I was told, you know, I'm your parent, you don't need an explanation. Mm-hmm. That's just the way it is. And I think it can be, that's just the way it is. But I think we also need to give our children an explanation. For a couple of reasons. One is, as you said, raising my children is a time for my education. I need to be willing to think through it. And maybe in thinking through it, I won't hold on to that. And then to the decision I made, I'll have to humbly go back to them. And it's also to help them think through things, not just kind of blindly obey or just blindly rebel, but to be able to have some information to consider. Kind of get inside our minds. And that's a big part of parenting, isn't just having them do something or having it look a certain way, but having them learn to think, to reason, to understand, to have the mind of their parents involved with that. So that's what I think a lot of parenting is on an ongoing basis. It's having a discussion both with myself and my children. I need to learn how to listen, and I need to help them learn how to listen, both to myself and to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a great book. It's pretty simple. I don't remember the authors, and it's either how to listen so kids will talk and how to talk so kids will listen, and it's kind of a techniquey book. But you know, I really think it's very helpful. I often recommend it to parents so that they can kind of start learning both from themselves and from their children. It's helpful.
Can you summarize the gist of it? What's
kind of what we've been saying. It's helping children. It's not just, it's a little bit more techniquey than what we've been saying, but instead of just saying, the child might say, why can't I do that? And you said, because I said so. You might explain it some more. The child might say something like, well, I'm really mad, Dad, that you won't let me watch that movie. And for you to say, well, you shouldn't be mad, is a direction they wouldn't go in, but help them explore why they're mad and what's going on and how that impacts their life, to help parents, you know, help get into discussion and conversations with their kids that's just not, you know, stopped short. And I think if we can learn to be very good listeners, we can be very much better parents, because we're understanding our children. And when we understand our children and we see them, they feel cared about, connected to, loved, involved with. And that's really a huge part of my involvement with my kids. It's not as much telling them what to do as they get older, but hearing them. And as I hear them, that's a little bit threatening to me, because I have to think through and reason with what I'm thinking and what's important to me. A big challenge for me has been the whole area of dating. Kids really want to go out, they call it, or have a boyfriend. Everybody has a boyfriend or they're not in. And it's like all the kids in the third grade have boyfriends, you know, or girlfriends. And that's just amazing to me. So I have to enter into and want to enter into a lot of discussions with my daughter about what is a boyfriend and what's that really mean and what are you really telling them by being physical or not being physical. And I don't even want to enter into that conversation anymore. I'm so tired of it. But it's quite a challenge to help them grow up really respecting another person rather than using another person. There's no help for me in the community or in our culture that comes alongside me and says, yeah, Christine, you're saying some good things, and kids, why don't you hear those? No, the society is really saying something very different. So it's a difficult discussion for me. It's a difficult involvement for me.
I think one of the things that I think that we've communicated, and perhaps not always, but I think we've communicated this to our children, is that my wife and I bear responsibility for the fact that we are marching to the beat of a different drum, and don't make my children pay for that. Don't just make them be always disappointed and just leave it at that. If I'm going to try to instill different values in my children, then what I need to communicate to them through my actions is, this is not about depriving you. I don't want you to be deprived. I'll do everything I can to go as far as I can to let you have what you want and experience what you want to experience. But because this is not about me depriving you, this is about learning a certain set of values and living by a certain set of values. For example, my wife or I was willing to drive my child a number of hours so that she could be at this weekend retreat with these kids. We just weren't going to allow her to be driven there by a 16-year-old. Well, I think that she was willing not to go and was okay with that, as disappointing as that was. And I think in part what in part made her willing to do that is that she realized that we weren't about depriving her of this weekend. That was not our intent. We would make sacrifices. We would be inconvenienced to allow her to have what it is she wanted to have, but there are just certain standards that we needed to, certain rules that we needed to have abided by. We were willing to pay the price rather than make her pay the price for having those rules. I think that communicates a lot to children. Then that makes it clear to them, this is not you against me, this is you being for a certain philosophy of parenting. What brought that to mind is in the area of dating. What about their need for friendships, for social interaction, and so on? Am I willing to open up my home to show hospitality, to go to the work, whatever it takes, to make possible another context for socializing or relationships or friends or whatever? Will I do whatever work it takes to create a little countercultural context for having those relationships? It'd be so easy to say, I'm too tired, I'm just not going to do that. So you're going to pay the price for me having different rules. You won't fit into your culture, but I'm not going to provide a counterculture for you. Well, then why? I mean, my job, I think, as a parent is to sacrifice whatever I need to sacrifice in order to be the steward that I need to be, to help nurture them in a way that doesn't deprive them unnecessarily, but is asking them to consider a whole different way of looking at life.
You know, one thing that, kind of going on a little bit different route than this, one thing that I've heard from my children that's been kind of surprising to me is that although I am very interested in listening to them, wanting to hear about their lives, wanting to interact with them about a lot, I think I was starving for that in my own life, wanted so much for adults to come alongside me and want to know me. But it's very interesting. My kids, as I've wanted to know them, haven't necessarily always wanted me to know them. You're kind of going, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And that's been very surprising to me. It's kind of been sad for me. I have wanted them to want me to know them. And I think part of the reason they don't want me to know them is because I haven't been safe, you know, in some ways. I'm critical sometimes or hurtful in some ways that maybe I'm not even aware of. Also because they want to get away with things, and if I knew about it, they couldn't get away with it as easily. It also comes just from growing up and wanting to be their own independent selves and to make their own decisions as best they can. So I think one of the ways of loving my children is to sometimes be willing not to know things that I'd really rather know. Do you have that experience?
Oh, yeah. That a real hunger to know about their day and the affairs of their day and how it went down. I mean, that's just inherently interesting to a parent, I think. I mean, at least it is to me. I find their lives fascinating, and for me to be able to just sort of vicariously enjoy their lives is a real delight to me. And yet they don't cooperate. It takes a real biting of my tongue and sitting back and going, no, just leave them alone. Give them some space. They'll talk if they want to talk, but you don't have a right to intrude into their life.
That's exactly right. We don't have a right to intrude. I would love to, but I think I've certainly been guilty of trying to intrude and then having to learn, okay, you blew it. Let's really back off. One of the things that's been really nice in our home, we moved about 2 years ago into a house that has a jacuzzi, and you know, that is really a cool thing. I'd recommend that to parents.
Loosens people's tongue.
It does. And it's just something that my 10-year-old as well as my 18-year-old enjoy.
Huh.
And it's been kind of a nice thing to sometimes sit there, and they seem to just kind of open up more. So that's one of my techniques for talking. Interestingly, after 2 years of being in that house, they're not quite as interested in talking. But you know what? I get them. Sometimes one of my sons will say, "I'm gonna go down the jacuzzi, Mom," and that's kind of his signal of saying, "Wanna come?" And very often we'll have conversation, you know, in there. Another thing that I've learned is to kind of shut up, and I find that my kids will talk to me because it gets kind of quiet, and after a while they're interested in saying something. So I just drive them home from school, the 20-minute ride, and after a while they're talking to me.
Mm-hmm.
But for me to say something positive like, "What's a good thing that happened in school today?" It's like, "Oh, brother, Mom."
Yeah.
I mean, I just
yeah.
get like zero with that. Or what's something I've tried even, "What's the really worst thing that happened in school?" Yeah. Bug off, Mom.
Yeah, but that's exactly our experience. I mean, the more we push, the more closed that they become. And it really is true that if you just shut up and give them their own time, then they'll start opening
and then
up.
Listen to them well when they start.
Yeah.
Like, "Well, wait a minute, you shouldn't be doing that." Or,
yeah.
"Gosh, you know, kind of being too cautious with them. But just kind of hearing what they're thinking, what's going on with them, giving open-ended questions or just reflecting what they've said. Again, going back to that book, How to Listen So Kids Will Talk and How to Talk So Kids Will Listen, I think is, for somebody who doesn't have many listening skills, I think that would be a very good book in this regard. I think a problem with learning to listen is we can, as I have done, I'm a pretty good listener, but I've been way too intrusive. Also, one of the things that my sons and my kids, all of them, are very comfortable and almost eager to tell me where I fail.
Yeah.
Not almost eager, they're quite eager. And one of the things that I was talking to my son once about, you know, why don't you guys like to talk? "Well, Mom, you talk about the most boring things." And they look at each other, my two sons look at each other, and they crack up. I didn't know they were boring things. They're interesting to me. But you're laughing. It's like, one of the reasons I don't know how to ask them interesting things is because they don't, you know, tell me all about their interest in things that they might think I might not approve of. And so they keep those things, I think, most quiet. Or just things, you know, they just want to be, again, their own person. So they're kind of quiet.
Well, the thing that I've come to realize is that I forget what it's like to be young. I forget what it's like to be a child, and I forget what it's like to experience a parent. Because I'm not experiencing my children the same way they're experiencing me, but I assume that they do.
Yes.
I assume that I am more their peer. And I forget how inherently intimidating a parent is to a child. And
I don't feel very intimidating.
Exactly. I don't feel at all intimidating, but I pick up clues every now and then how intimidating I am to them, and I go, "Whoa, I'm just Jackie to my mother."
Yeah. I'm just Chrissy.
Uh-huh. So I sometimes have to remind myself, but wait a minute, remember who you are and remember how they're experiencing you. That what you think is just little helpful advice, they're experiencing as this horrendous criticism. And you didn't mean it that way, you didn't intend it that way, but that's how they experience it. And no wonder they don't tell you much, because you're giving your advice all the time. You're commenting, you're jumping in and giving them your perspective. And they don't just take it as a peer kind of chatting.
Mm-hmm.
They take it as a parent. Here comes my parent again.
Mm-hmm.
And when I remember that that's how they experience it, then I realize, well, of course. I mean, that's why I need to back off and get some space.
That's a great reminder.
Practically speaking, there is nothing more practical than the truth of the gospel. However, many times we wish the Bible to be more obviously applicable to our everyday struggles. We want our pastors and Bible teachers to show us how Christianity offers clear solutions to our problems. In the News and Views article, Practically Speaking, Mackenzie Study Center teacher Ron Julian argues that the teaching of the Bible is not about techniques for a happy life, Rather, the Bible continually calls us to re-examine the profound story of what God is doing in creation. A story which has many implications for our view of God, ourselves, and the world. On the surface, this may seem very theoretical and not very practical. However, the gospel is profoundly practical and life-changing. But by its very nature, it is a set of ideas. We need to be reminded of those ideas over and over again. Thus, the most practical thing a person can do is to base their choices and decisions on the foundation of truth presented to us in the Bible. Contact Mackenzie and ask for your copy of Practically Speaking by Ron Julian.
We do continue to receive letters from you, our listeners, and we keep on telling you, thank you for your letters. But I want to say that I don't think we've received enough letters. It is really important to us to know the impact of our ministry, what it is that's helpful to you, and what it is that's not helpful to you. Recently, Jack received a letter from somebody who is very concerned about the monthly letter that we send out, and really disagreed with Jack, and followed that letter up here very recently, and said this, and I'd like to read the letter because I really think it is the mark of a Christian who's willing to see themselves and honestly confront what's going on in their lives and in their thoughts and in their actions. And this is really an example of that. She begins by saying, I want to ask your forgiveness for trying to fix you in the letter I wrote on March 16th. It was in response to your March letter to supporters of Christianity at Work. And I'm going to skip down some. She says, I know I must face my fears or die of them. This doesn't mean that I strike out against anyone physically. It just means I need to get in touch with the real Jesus, not the one of my dreams. And I think that's very much what we're trying to do here. Is I think lots of times we have this idea of we want Jesus to be in our life, and that's not it at all. We have to face into the reality of who Jesus is. That takes a lot of courage, and I really appreciate the courage of this person to recognize when they were wrong and be willing to ask for forgiveness. And she says, please forgive me for trying to squelch your freedom of speech. I'm sorry for the pain I shoved your way. I know that concerning pagans of history being morally better than many present born-again Christians, I have much to learn. I'm sure I can stand to grow in evidencing an authentic and substantial commitment to godliness in all its forms, too. So, pretty great letter.
Yeah, it is. And I want to reassure her that I did not in any way take offense at her initial letter. It was very respectful and very kind, actually. But I think it's great that she has the kind of courage to evaluate herself, to evaluate her ideas, and to learn new things and to come to new perspectives. That's very commendable.
I underlined that so many times, and I guess if there's anything that we would like more than anything else, is that not that people have more information in their heads, but it works itself out in their lives, and I think very much it's working itself out in her life.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. Tapes can be purchased with check or Visa. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The Mackenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the Mackenzie staff in their ministry through their classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The Mackenzie Study Center is a non-profit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to Mackenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to Mackenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. 877-207-9743. If you would like to request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now, on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.